Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. I love what James Tracy said of her. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz has defined the term engaged intellectual through a life spent on the front lines of the past four decades of social struggles. She has never abandoned her roots through the process of becoming one of the most respected left academics in the United States. She's the author of Red Dirt, Outlaw Woman, Blood on the Border, Roots of Resistance, The Great Sioux Nation, which has just been re-released. So I guess for my first question, you know, when I was preparing for the interview, I just kept thinking about all the different aspects of your work. And one of the things I just absolutely love about your work is the way you bring together so beautifully class analysis, feminism, indigenous struggles, militants, a critique of capitalism, the importance of storytelling, and everything else. So this is really great, but it left me sort of at a loss as to, you know, which one of these threads do I want to pick out. So what I'm going to do is just completely punt on choosing a thread. And instead, my first question is going to be, can you tell me how your own thought has developed through your lifetime to bring together all these concerns?
Well, you know, I've thought about that a lot because it's a little mysterious even to me, and I'm not religious at all, but sometimes I believe in some kind of predestination because how I got where I am now. But I think the seed for social justice was planted in me very early. I mean, beyond just... I should explain, you know, that I grew up extremely poor, rural, and isolated. My father was a sharecropper. We moved around in a county in Oklahoma on different farms, working on different farms, sometimes renting farms, sometimes sharecropping. A very, very rugged childhood. And there were no books. There was nothing to bring us news of the outside world except maybe soldiers coming back from war, pumped up with an Americanism. And the preacher in the Baptist church we went to, who usually came from somewhere else, the state over, somewhere else in the region, but not from our town. So it was, you know, it was a very isolated world. But my father was almost a shrine in our cabins that always moved with us to my grandfather, my father's father, Emmett Dunbar, because he had in that, you know, little farming community where I grew up, my dad had grown up. My grandfather had been in the Socialist Party and the Industrial Workers of the World, an organizer. And my father was very proud of him. My father was not politically progressive at all. He was fairly apolitical. I call the first chapter in my memoir of growing up in Oklahoma, Red Diaper Baby with a question mark, that later when I would meet red diaper babies of communists of the 40s and 50s, I would see they had a real ambivalence about how they grew up, seeing their parents go through what they did in the McCarthy era. And of course, the Socialist Party and the Industrial Workers of the World, which were very large in Oklahoma, actually the largest Socialist Party members per capita in the from 1900 to 1922 was in Oklahoma. So it wasn't a fringe group, you know. They controlled almost all the school boards and towns, and almost controlled the state, came very close to it. So it was, and then it was destroyed very systematically with the Woodrow Wilson's Red raids, you know, Red Scare concerning World War One. Those who opposed the war and the Socialist Party, notably in the United States, unlike Europe, was fiercely opposed to the war itself and U.S. entrance into it and conscription, and went to prison for it, beaten up by goons, by the Ku Klux Klan, was born again. So my father suffered a lot watching that. He was a kid. So when the final blows came and his father was more or less run out of the area, moved to the Rio Grande Valley, took the family to the Rio Grande Valley, my dad stayed behind in the town, but he was only 15 at that time. So in the whole time his father had been active, well, my father was born in 1907, and my grandfather was already extremely active. So it was his childhood. But he talked about it. He talked about his father all the time in the most glowing terms and just told the stories. He was a great storyteller, and he told the stories of that time. And I was a sickly child with asthma, and I think, well, my mother and father were both great storytellers, and I loved being, and my brother, older brother and sister too. So I was filled with stories, but these were the stories that I identified with most. I wanted to grow up and be like my grandfather. I saw him as a superhero, you know, what kids think of as superhero now. I wanted to be like him. And of course, when I left home, I didn't know how to do that at all. I had no prescription for it. There were no models for it in my world. Even when I moved to Oklahoma City, there were, but they were very, I found out later there were protesters, but they were so isolated by that time. It was a complete oil monopoly, right-wing, oligarchic place, and no socialism to be seen anywhere. But it seemed like I was like a magnet, being drawn to the magnets of radicals, because they came out of the woodwork, and I wasn't looking for them, but they just appeared before me. My house mother, my first year on scholarship at University of Oklahoma, turned out to be a socialist and a lesbian, you know, and she told me about, she was quite open, you know, and she got fired. So almost everyone I knew, you know, would get fired while I knew them because they were outspoken, but I really admired that outspokenness. So I started speaking out. First and foremost, my senior year of high school, I was at a trade school in Oklahoma City. It was the first year of integration. And I didn't have any opinions really before that time on race because, our only connection, you know, interchange with African Americans was, you know, when we would go picking cotton. Certain times of year, we would, you know, the families, poor families would go pick cotton. And there were black families picking cotton. That's actually just, there was not that much interaction, seeing black people like us, you know, just poor and picking cotton. But I didn't have any opinions and much knowledge, you know, about the civil rights movement. This was like 55, 56. I was at that school. But there were sit-ins in Oklahoma. There was a sit-in at the big grocery coffee shop, like Woolworth's, only it was called Katz Drugstore. And that happened in 1955. So it was long before the big wave of sit-ins. And I've since learned that it was very advanced in Oklahoma, and this great woman leader, Claire Looper. But I knew nothing about that at the time. So, but I did find, had a sense of justice, you know, and this was wrong, you know, the white kids in the school beating up and really, really harassing the few black students who had been brought in to integrate the first school integrated in Oklahoma, fights in the hall. So I took the side of the blacks. You know, I didn't really make any black friends. I just would argue with people about racism. So I even wrote about it. You know, I was on the school paper, and there I also got influenced by my teacher. It was I was just drawn, you know. So that's the only way I can explain it. It was very haphazard because I felt like I was this vessel that had to be filled. So I just, you know, I didn't know how to actually go out and find my own way. When I moved to San Francisco when I was 20, and there were demonstrations, the HUAC demonstrations, the anti-death penalty. I had become very anti-death penalty. I can't remember who put that idea in my mind, but I was very anti-death penalty. And I so wanted to go and know those people, but I actually thought that you had to be invited to go to a demonstration. You know, being raised to, you don't go where you don't belong, and you can't ever assume that you belong, that you had to have an invitation to go to a demonstration. So it all made me very sensitive to how to organize, not to assume just because you have a big demonstration, even a huge one, that ordinary people will necessarily know what it's about, know that they can join you. I didn't really join a demonstration until 1965, when we had our first Vietnam War demonstration, and I was dragged to it, you know, by a friend, and it was very small, you know, at that time, and it was kind of scary, and there were only about 10 people, mainly the organizers there, but it was a definite shift. After that, I knew I had the right to be in those places and even started organizing things like that. But my feminism, I think everything, you know, I was very proud to be working class. My dad instilled that in me because my grandfather died fighting for the poor and working class. And I assumed that every kind of rebuff I had or put down or discrimination, which I experienced a lot, I always assumed it was class. I don't talk like them, or not as educated or as good, but I kept the core of my pride in being working class and just dismissed it as elitism. So it wasn't until I was a graduate student at UCLA in history, a doctoral graduate student, that I was out of the, you know, the realm of where I felt I could be put down for a class. I had achieved an equal status, and I had also learned how to respond, you know, to class, to elitism. But something else was happening, and I realized it was because I was a woman. You know, when one of the male graduate students who wasn't married, they all had wives, you know, who typed for them and everything, and I did all my own work. And one single graduate student reached out with a handwritten thing and said, could you type this up for me? And I said, why? Why would I do that? I mean, he wasn't even a close friend or anything, certainly not a boyfriend. And so things like that happened, you know, and one professor told me outright, one of the professors on my committee, you know, that had to be on my committee because I was doing Latin American history, and he was a historian of Spain. He was not Spanish. He was a white guy, but he actually told me that he was going to do everything he could to keep me from getting a PhD because women did not belong in the history field.
Hmm.
So that was pretty obvious. And so I got angrier and angrier, and as I got, at the same time, I was getting more and more involved in movements. And then I started seeing it in those movements, which I assumed were immune from, you know, from that, the same kind of treatment as I got involved. So that's really what made a feminist. I can't say that I had any kind of, you know, like women talk about they were tomboys. I was a sickly little kid. I was a little girl. I didn't have any. I played with dolls and loved it, and I didn't have any of the things that other women often talk about that they could see that why they became feminist. For me, it was just pure outrage and anger at how I was treated. And then I already had, and by that time I already had in my mind that liberation only came collectively. So I didn't at all look at, like, well, how could I achieve as a woman then? It was how can I help liberate all women. And so that came kind of naturally. I don't know how I missed, around that time I read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex and Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook, and I didn't even know about Betty Friedan's books, A Feminist Mystique. It was sort of, I don't know, just outside the world of radicalism that I had gotten involved in. I'm not sure what I would have thought of that. I think, you know, had I read it when it came out in, I think it was 1962 or 63, I kind of shuddered to think that it might have made me more of an individualist feminist because I wasn't yet quite cooked as a radical, you know, so I'm glad I missed it.
I think, is there more, or do you want me to ask another question?
Well, that's kind of how everything came together, and then how it all integrates into me, I'm not sure, because the way things are segregated, you know, into issues and identities and all, I sometimes feel like I'm, you know, many personalities that I can fit into all of these different groups, but I can't really bring, I feel now I can bring my feminism with me anywhere. I can bring my class stance anywhere. What I can't bring is the other part of me, my mother's part, the more troublesome part, my mother being an alcoholic and all, but and having been an orphan, but the Indian part, I find that's the most difficult for me to bring into any space that's not specifically indigenous without getting kind of just patronized. I'm fine, you know, with my students or when I'm in a teaching situation. I love it because it's a real challenge, but with, you know, in the movements, I feel that it's never quite grasped or understood. It's kind of, oh yes, you know, that we agree. There's always agreement, you know, no pushback, as my students do, and you know, it's a challenge. But just that kind of politeness, politely, yes, and then going on to another subject, which is how feminism was treated at first. But this seems, you know, far more difficult problem because it gets to the root of settler colonialism and the whole history of the United States, the whole accepted version of what the United States is or could be, or the kind of Howard Zinn people's history of great triumphs of resistance, but, you know, and Native Native Americans as an add-on to that, and it just doesn't fit because of settler colonialism and labor movements. So even in myself, you know, I can talk labor forever. I can talk feminism forever. I can talk African slavery and racism forever in any situation, and I can combine all those. But the basis to my thinking, you know, for the last 40 years has been understanding of settler colonialism and indigenous peoples' rights and aspirations. And I always feel like I have to leave that aside. So that's the real dilemma for me of, you know, kind of integrating what I can do and what I can write and make sense, you know, that it's... So one solution for that was a book I just finished called Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States.
So there are a bunch of directions that I would like to go with this. And I guess I want to, before I go to the directions that were raised by all the other comments you were making, okay, here's the deal, is that you were saying all of the stuff early on, and that was one of the things I wanted to talk about. Was it seems that one of the things I think is very important that we often forget is the importance of intergenerational associations or intergenerational nature of resistance movements. That, you know, your grandfather passed on, I mean, things passed through your family down to you, and that resistance, you know, we don't know if it would have been possible or if your resistance would be as strong as it is without your grandfather. And we see this in so many resistance movements. And that was one of the directions I wanted to go with that. But then I realized as you were talking about the way that the indigenous resistance gets shunted off to the side, that if I were to ask that question now, I would be doing the same thing that we were just talking about. So I really want to come back to that because I think it's so important, but I would also like to ask you about, I mean, you said some, but I guess I just would like to hear more and understand better. Why do you think it is that it is harder to integrate that? Is that, you know, I've had, over the years, I've had a number of indigenous people say to me that they just feel like indigenous and settler mindsets are so different that they can't understand each other at all. And is it that, I mean, I don't know. It seems like if one were to really open to even the remotest bits of indigenous understanding. It's like so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. And that for, you know, Vine Deloria told me that the, you know, from his perspective, his understanding of the point of life for an indigenous person would be to that the entire world is this beautiful symphony, and your role is to figure out what your role is in the symphony, and to play that role at the right time in the right place in the right harmony with everybody else. And that's a completely different perspective than anything associated with capitalism or with the dominant culture going back thousands of years. So is that why it's so much harder to bring in? Is because the mindsets are so different, or is that completely off? Why do you think it is? Why do you think that's so often? Because I see it too, from my own white perspective. I see it getting shunted off all the time. So why do you think that is? How is that?
That's a beautiful quote from Vine Deloria. He's a mentor of mine, but I never heard him put it quite that way. I've heard it. Put by Henry Krodog and Thomas Banyaka, Hopi, you know, from so many different elders from different nations, that comes down to the same thing, but that's a beautiful way of putting it. But the way it's explained to me is that the problem is that the objectifying of human beings as irrelevant, you know, the environmental movement does that a lot, that here it said that, you know, want to save the earth and save all of nature, be in harmony with nature, and as if the human being isn't an integral part of all that, that somehow the human being is devalued because of our specific capabilities, you know, of destruction outside of our necessity, you know, for existence. So it's sort of we're outside of we have these minds that can destroy, but this mind is really meant to be finding our place in the order of things, like Vine says, and our place in the order of that that symphony. But individualism, which is, you know, a product of capitalism, the atomization of human beings I used to, you know, as a feminist, really attack the nuclear family, because I do think the nuclear family is where that individualism is nourished, where you practice and pull the knives out and, you know, fight each other and all, and this kind of training, you know, of what you're supposed to do in life to be top dog. And so I think it's the self-degradation, I hear it over and over, well, the earth will be fine, it's human, you know, it's human beings who will be destroyed. But that seems like, you know, it's kind of giving the earth a character that is somehow superior, or that, you know, that human beings are just no damn good, you know, it comes down to that. And this reverence that you learn as an indigenous person, or from indigenous mentors. I mean, I never learned these things growing up. I would say we certainly had to have a lot of mutual aid as poor people to survive. And I think most poor people exhibit these, you know, character of individualism much less than people who can afford to be autonomous, you know, and to be individuals. But probably most people, if they got the chance, would get out of the situation of survival and live better. Or people strive for that, you know, or they're told they should. And fortunately, many fail to do that, so they retain their humanity. But I think that human beings are sacred, you know, just as all of nature and all the other creatures are sacred. It's part of, you know, sacred life, and all languages are sacred. No language is a colonial language, like English or French or Spanish. Yes, some colonizers use those languages. That doesn't mean the language is itself evil or inherently corrupt. it's certainly a lot of corruption of each of those languages, but there's something deeper than those corruptions that is sacred. So I think there's a kind of self-hatred that goes along with the extreme narcissism in the culture that it is very hard. I understand it because I've been around it. It's hard to say I grew up with it because it was such a different world of survival. But once I became, on the track of getting a BA and then getting an MA and then a PhD and working in situations where I wanted to, that kind of ambitious thing before I got with the American Indian Movement in 1974. Up until that time, even the movement, I think the feminist movement had a big impact on me, but a lot of it was superficial, I found later. The kind of collectivity and all was everyone was still kind of knocking each other over for the book contracts or the tenure or whatever. A lot of individualism. But yeah, that not seeing oneself as a sacred being is something I think even people involved in New Age things or like Buddhism and everything, they want to lose themselves rather than to enhance themselves, kind of lose themselves into themselves, not really into the community. And the thing is that an indigenous person doesn't lose him or herself or their selves in this symphony. You have a very distinctive relationship with everything, and it's not necessarily static. It's different things at different times in your life. And I think, most Native Americans are more vivid personalities than most people rarely forget someone, a Native American they meet, because very vivid personality, negative or positive, it stands out as a fully formed kind of personality, whereas a lot of people I meet, I forget, they start all looking alike sometimes, Like at a conference I was just at last week, I was having a hard time distinguishing people from each other because they didn't present like a full person, And so that's all kind of rambling around. But I do think Vine, had... Now, what's the cause of that? I don't think it's something racial or DNA or inherited, although I think a lot of indigenous people start thinking like that because it, it just seems so unbreakable or such a divide. But I do think it's developed historically that that everyone was once... indigenous, and everyone was once part of collectives, and class relations developed. Suppression of women probably came before class relations, and then modern times in the 1400s, 1500s, racism based on skin color developed with the reintroduction of chattel slavery that was no longer based on a lifetime of bondage labor, rather as an inherited racial characteristic. That was new under the face of the sun, in the 14th, 15th century, when colonialism modern colonialism began. So these are historical developments, and I'm not sure it's transferable that indigenous people are often asked to give of this knowledge, but it's sort of taken as you know, pieces of things rather than something that I'm not sure can be changed without the conditions for change taking place. And that's kind of a catch-22, because the kind of social movements that develop that do not accept some fundamental things about the United States, that is its settler colonialism, and what settler colonialism does to the mind. They read Fanon, but they don't seem to get Fanon's point about, you know, black skin, white mass, you know, about settler colonialism. And they accept what, you know, the effects it has on the native, but they're not looking at his, well, studies in the dying colonialism, his psychoanalytical work on settlers, you know, white settlers, French settlers. And their, the mentality, it's very, very deep stuff. I wish he could have done more of it, because I know really no one else does that work now, to understand what happens to the settler, and in denial that there's any such thing. I mean, people throw around the term now, but they kind of see it then as, you know, a kind of substitute for other words that have been used in the past, like racism or white supremacy. And you know, you can have racism and white supremacy and, of course, misogyny and every other horror in the world without having settler colonialism. But settler colonialism, colonialism, capitalism in general, create a certain mindset. And I think what's troubling about Native Americans is not the, you know, culture, language, you know, that, oh, that's fine, that's really interesting, and people can do their own thing now. But the land, you know, land and sovereignty, that this is what is, you know, very troubling, because if I pose the question always when I'm talking about this, and I've been talking about it quite a bit lately, because my 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, came out in March, a new edition. So I've been doing book talks, and it's about the restoration of the Black Hills, the sacred lands of the Sioux, to the Sioux people, and about loss of land, regaining, you know, the original land base under the 1868 treaty. And that's just one case of all of the, you know, different Native nations' aspirations. And I just lay it out, you know, if we started with one thing, like returning all the sacred sites to Native people, would anyone here really find that bothersome? I mean, why would it be something you might be against or people would be against? And they all said, oh, there's no reason it should be done. And I said, okay, let's start with Yellowstone Park. You know, that's a sacred site. Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, the Black Hills, you know, all the national parks are sacred sites of Native people. They were very consciously taken as such. They knew very well that this was the spiritual basis, you know, of peoples. That they, Vine writes about that a lot, how you can't carry out your duties as a Lakota if you couldn't go up into the Black Hills to certain geographical places to practice. So it doesn't mean that other people couldn't be invited in too, but this, then they kind of balk, you know, and say, they're not sure they wouldn't like to just go camping in Yosemite whenever they wished, you know, or Mesa Verde or the Black Hills. And, you know, so it then begins to seep in the implications of how that might be turned around and really humanized. But if it's not put into really concrete terms like that, if it stays in the cultural and dances and handicrafts and things, then it doesn't really, you know, I think the mascot thing is very significant. People try to brush it off as, well, it's just a stupid thing, you know. Yeah, I mean, now people are saying, yeah, Redskin, but the, you know, they're not really getting to the why. Most people call it trivial, you know, kind of trivial. Even a lot of Native Americans said, you know, we have a lot of bigger issues. And it's true, you know, land and the treaties and the poverty and the alcoholism and all of the vestiges of colonialism are... they're all there, and they're horrible. They're killing people. Native Americans have a lifespan of 47 years, you know. And but it is important because it's bringing out into public discussion genocide, because that red skin is the blood-filled bodies of the Pequot that the Puritans called Redskins, because those they didn't kill but captured, they flayed them. They took their skin off. They were always, and through the 19th century, skinning the Indians they killed and making lampshades and tobacco pouches, including Andrew Jackson proudly carried his staff of tobacco pouch out, made out of creek skins. And when you skin a person, you end up with blood. You know, if you skin an animal, you skin anything, you end up with a blood-covered, blood-soaked body. So here are these blood-soaked bodies all over the place. So they're the Redskins. And ever after that, Redskin refers to a dead Indian. And that's coming out now, you know. It's not just the use of the name, it's what's behind it, and that people think it's okay to keep using that word as a reference when it turns the blood of Native people, living Native people, to ice, you know, when they hear it, or boiling over with anger. And, you know, it's true, the 49ers, that seems benign. Our football team's called the 49ers. Well, these were the genocidal settlers of California who wiped out, you know, very, very intentionally the Northern California Indians in the Gold Rush. These are the 49ers.
And were paid a bounty for individual...
Oh, from the beginning, for heads at first, and then as it came down for scalps and various body parts, yeah. And we see that happening in Vietnam with the ears that were collected, you know, and the souvenirs that were sent back, body parts from Vietnam. And this is not normal in war, you know. I mean, it's a settler colonial mentality. And then the militarization, this war, this country being founded on war and genocide, colonial, you know, settler wars against the Indians, has so many implications of, as Richard Sotkin puts it, regeneration through violence, that every generation there has to be a war to kind of justify that, you know, psychologically justify that genocide, that it's just no accident, you know. And in the present, you know, and for the last 20 or 30 years, there's this insistence on the left that all this dates to 1948 and the national security state, that before then, everything was okay, you know. I mean, it was was FDR, you know, everything was okay. And that is so ridiculous. You know, they used to, historians, of course, never have dated imperialism to 1948, but they date it to 1898, overseas imperialism, not to the continent, or even the taking of half of Mexico. So it's...
Well, that's just crazy, because I love the line by the anthropologist Stanley Diamond, that civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you go back to the cradle of civilization, you know, that civilization has been a story of conquest. That's how you gain, and when you destroy your own land base, you are of necessity forced into conquest, either that or collapse. And from the beginning, this culture has been doing that. That there were indigenous peoples all through the Near East. They were through North Africa, the forests of North Africa went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. It's amazing to me that people can start the process at 1948 or 1898. I mean, you know, the Pequots say hello, you know?
Well, the thing is that when you then go back to the origins of humanity to talk about it in that context, I think it's a big distortion, because I think, as a historian, there was a clear break with history in a different direction, and, you know, symbolically 1492, that we are a part of now. And that's what we have. Yeah, those elements are there. But the monster that the United States is would not have come from that had it not been for a totally different era of capitalism, colonialism, and slavery, and settler colonialism. It's and of course race-based slavery. So I think it's often used, the whole guns, germs, and steel, and all this to actually.
I was saying Stanley Diamond, not Jared Diamond. I actually disagree strongly with
Jared Stanley. I'm just referring to Jared Diamond. I know you were referring to Stanley Diamond.
Okay, great.
Yeah. But I hear it a lot, you know, that also like the invasion of Iraq and in 2003, people started talking about the Roman Empire. I said, let's talk about the U.S., you know. I mean, okay, the Roman Empire existed, and definitely the Holy Roman Empire, but what we have to look at is the Holy Roman Empire and the Crusades, and that is the fundamental basis for what came, you know, how settler colonialism and racism developed. So I think we have to be historians and not just, you know, not, and get to the specifics of the United States, because when we generalize, you'd be surprised. It's a thing that students are taught in school in the last, since the 60s, when all of these issues have been brought up, U.S. imperialism and all, when they can no longer really rationalize that there's not something to it, as the powers that be started, or their minions in academia started hustling to get with the program and get on top of it and keep the what I call the origin narrative of the United States, they had to broaden it. The U.S. in world history, and yes, making a lot of the same mistakes that human beings have always made repetitively, but there's something different going on. We're now on the edge of total human annihilation that is mostly caused by the United States. I mean, it had other participants. Now that is where, you know, 1948 maybe becomes an important marker, because the European powers pretty much destroyed each other and are no longer the biggest factor in the world, or collective factor along with the United States. But we have such a responsibility here, and that brings the Native question into even more a central, you know, should be centered, because U.S. history without that is always wrongly, however liberal. I mean, Howard Zinn is, you know, I love him dearly, and he's a great person, but I think he made things worse, you know, with his revising history to say the beautiful thing about the United States is resistance. And that is always beautiful in human beings, but anyway, you know, it depends on the resistance. Who's resisting what? The Confederacy resisted the Union annexation of, you know, or the Union demanding it change. They resisted with a war, but that doesn't, you know, really, the word in itself, you know, it's not a, and it sort of makes it that, and I call it, you know, now settler colonialism resistance. It's produced a labor struggle, it's produced historic feminism, it's produced all kinds of, you know, important situations we have now, but it hasn't really gotten to, we haven't really changed the core, we haven't changed the origin narrative, that we've altered it, revised it. There was a time, you know, the main theme of that new origin narrative that simply leaves the settler colonial one in place, is that we're a nation of immigrants. And people sometimes will say, oh, well, you know, except for the Indians, like the Indians don't count, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. And textbooks in the early 90s, I'm not sure, I haven't looked lately, but they actually went so far as to identify Native peoples as the first immigrants. So they integrated Native people into this nation of immigrants conceptualization. And it's still a very strong conceptualization. I think that Native people of Canada erroneously and mistakenly call themselves First Nations because they're original nations. You know, they're colonized nations and not first, you know, in a line of legitimate nations, Canada and the United States.
Right. What you're saying is incredibly important, and I've loved this whole conversation. The thing is, we're over time.
Oh, we're over time. Well, it's so great talking. Really went fast.
I'm so sorry, because it's like we should do this again. We'll do this for another 45 minutes another time. So we'll put it on pause.
Okay.
And because once again, this is all fabulous, and I'm so grateful for all your work. And I've been going, oh, my God, I don't want to interrupt her, but we are over time.
Okay, good.
So I need to close off now.
Well, thanks, Derek, and let me know when it's going to play, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, I did too. And thank you all for being on the show, and thank you for listening. And my guest today has been Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.